We're continuing our study this week, taking a closer look at Jesus Christ. The reason for that is expressed by Paul in 2 Corinthians chapter 3, that we may look upon His image and be transformed into the image of His likeness. That is our desire in this life, to be more and more like Christ every day, so that that will prepare us for the eternal kingdom beyond this veil of tears. We're looking tonight in Mark, the Gospel of Mark, chapter 7, and since the controversy with the Jewish leaders was growing more intense, and since it was not the time for Christ to be delivered up and to sacrifice His life, He left Galilee and went northwest into the area of the city of Tyre and Sidon, an area of the country that was inhabited by pagans. And as you recall, the Jews normally had no dealings with Gentiles, either their property or their people, because to them it communicated an uncleanness, according to the tradition of the elders that we looked at in our lesson last week. And Mark may very well be including these events with the Gentiles right after he tells us about clean and unclean for a specific reason. We overlook Mark sometimes as a skillful writer, I think, underscoring the principles that he revealed to us in his gospel by showing examples like this. The church to which Mark originally wrote this gospel, of course, would be one that would benefit by reassurance that the Gentiles were indeed clean before God as a result of their obedience to the gospel of Christ. And so immediately we see Jesus reaching out to a Gentile person, a person that the Palestinian rabbis would have considered unclean. Number one, strike one, if you will, she's a woman. Strike two, she is of the wrong ethnic background. She is a Syrophoenician, Mark says in his record. And strike three, in terms of national influence, she's a Greek. So she comes to Jesus with a problem, and Jesus, who had just stated what uncleanness is really all about, reached out to help this Gentile woman. Look with me, if you will, in our text, chapter 7, beginning in verse 24. Jesus got up and went away from there to the region of Tyre, and when he had entered a house, he wanted no one to know of it, yet he could not escape notice. But after hearing of him, a woman whose little daughter had an unclean spirit immediately came and fell at his feet. Now the woman was a Gentile of the Syrophoenician race, and she kept asking him to cast the demon out of her daughter. And he was saying to her, "Let the children be satisfied first, for it is not good to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs." But she answered and said to him, "Yes, Lord, but even the dogs under the table feed on the children's crumbs." And he said to her, "Because of this answer, go. The demon has gone out of your daughter." And going back to her home, she found the child lying on the bed, the demon having left. Tyre is one of those cities of Phoenicia, Phoenicia being a country that was controlled by Syria, to the northwest of the area of Galilee, starting about the city of Caesarea on the coast and going northward from there past Mount Carmel, up further north and kind of curling around over the top of Galilee. And Tyre was about 40 miles northwest of Capernaum. Jesus is in definite Gentile territory here. And the previous incident shows Jesus wiping out this distinction between clean and unclean foods, according to Mark's record, which was written many years after this, and many years after the crucifixion of Christ, many years after his last will and testament, what we call the New Testament, came into force with people. Can it be here that maybe in symbol we have him wiping out the difference between clean and unclean people? It seems to be the case. Just as the Jew would never soil his lips with forbidden food, so he would never soil his life by contact with the unclean Gentile. And Jesus may be saying here, by implication, that the Gentiles are not unclean, that they too have a place in God's kingdom, which we will see unfold as we continue through the New Testament and read about the conversion of Gentiles in the book of Acts. Maybe Jesus went into this territory for a temporary escape. In his own country, he was, as you remember, under attack from every side. Long ago, the scribes and the Pharisees had branded him a sinner, and because he broke through the rules and regulations that they had established, they were interested in doing away with him. Herod regarded him as a menace. The people of Nazareth treated him scandalously. You remember the people of his own hometown. The hour would come when he would face his enemies and speak to them directly from God, but that time was not yet. Before it came, he would seek the peace and the quiet of seclusion and withdraw himself for specific purposes, we're sure. To draw closer to his disciples, to teach them things they needed to know after he was gone, to strengthen them and encourage them for the battles that they would most definitely face in the time ahead. It's really a forecast, I think, of the whole of Christianity, speaking in terms of how the Jews would be rejected and how the Gentiles would be invited into God's kingdom. Our modern sensibilities, I think, can be somewhat offended by a story like this. First, we're likely to take offense at this whole notion of separation between Jews and Gentiles, this inequality that seemed to exist in society of that day. We live in times that promote a greater degree of equality, and we work rather hard, I think, in maintaining that, in advancing that, and avoiding the type of distinctions that we read about between Jew and Gentile on the pages of the New Testament. Second, we're almost certain to be confused and offended by Jesus' opening reply to the woman, "Let the children be satisfied first, for it's not good to take the children's bread and throw it to dogs." Is that somewhat of a shocking statement to you? The dog was not really the well-loved guardian, man's best friend of the house that sits in your lap when you come home from work. Not in this way of speaking. It was really more a symbol of dishonor, both to Greeks and to Jews. You recall a passage like Matthew 7 and verse 6 where Jesus said, "Do not give what is holy to dogs." And there are other passages like that in the New Testament. Philippians 3 and verse 2 and Revelation 22 and verse 15, just to name a couple. And the word dog was in fact sometimes a Jewish word of contempt when cast in the teeth of Gentiles because of their idolatrous and immoral ways. And upon hearing a statement like this, most people would have turned around and walked away in anger, wouldn't you think? But not this woman. So how are we to explain Jesus' use of the term dogs here? Is our Lord using language that is of a racist or derogatory way? I don't think our Lord would do that, would you? But maybe in this instance, it is for a specific purpose because we know the outcome of the story. Mark records that for us. and it's a very good outcome. It's a test of this woman's faith. Matthew records more about this incident than Mark does, as Mark is relating it to Gentiles and Matthew really relating it to Jews. At first, Jesus didn't answer this woman a word. He ignored what she said. And then she tried to approach Jesus through the disciples, and they came to Jesus. Matthew's record says in chapter 15 and verse 23, imploring him, saying, "Send her away because she keeps shouting at us." And Jesus explained to the disciples, "I was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel." You see, that may be a key for us to understand what's going on here. Then he turned to answer the woman after she came and began to bow down before him, saying, "Lord, help me." The answer of Jesus really intended to put her off. He didn't want to deal with her. He didn't want to be averted from what he was doing at the time, which was obviously very important. When he tells her, "Let the children be satisfied first." That phrase is really a description of the Jews as God's children and their rights to the coming kingdom that Jesus was here to proclaim, I think. The children's bread, in some respects, would refer to the Messiah and the manna, the bread of life, that he would provide for his people. Maybe our tendency to be upset here is somewhat an evidence of our pride, possibly, and can help us understand why Jesus really started this way with this woman and with others. Why did he call the Pharisees hypocrites, you think? Is he saying that every person who was a Pharisee was a hypocrite? Every single one? I don't think so. Why did he call the Gentiles dogs when his intention was really to include them in his kingdom? There has to be a reason for that. Part of the answer, I think, lies in the fact that Jesus was a Jew speaking out of the culture and the vocabulary of his time. That has to explain it to some extent. But maybe to a larger and more significant extent is that these shocking affronts to people were really designed maybe to test them and to see what they were made of. Because it certainly put this woman to the test, and we saw what she was made of, clearly, didn't we? We see that when we read this account of this woman's incredible faith. Either the faith and the humility of a person will be exposed as being counterfeit, or it will shine through as being genuine, as it did in the case of this woman. Let's ask ourselves, what in the story would have offended us? And how would we have responded? And our answers will reveal quite a bit about ourselves, I think. We might say, "Well, if that's the way he feels, I'm never coming to him again for help." And walk away. Some people do that, don't they? No one likes being called a hypocrite or an evil generation or a brood of vipers that Jesus called some people on one occasion or whitewashed tombs. He referred to Herod as a fox. That wasn't a compliment of Herod at all. And now he calls people dogs. And our pride kind of kicks in and we think, "Well, I'm never going to come back to this guy again for anything." And then we do what most people do in that type of situation. We turn to the gods of our own imagination and our own device, because our own created, made-up gods in our minds are more pleasant for us and make us feel more comfortable. Only when we are truly desperate will we be willing to do whatever it takes, even if it means humbling ourselves before God. It's the fact that the woman didn't turn away in a huff. That's really a key to the blessings that she receives here. She apparently accepted the fact that this Jewish rabbi was teaching for the benefit of his own people and fulfilling the expectations of their scriptures. She understood that. But she was desperate. And she believed in the power of God, and she knew where to go to access the power of God, Jesus the Christ. She accepted her place as an outsider in the Lord's ministry. She granted that she was unworthy to really make any demand of Him whatsoever. And so, allowing the Jews the status of children, and accepting herself as one of the dogs, she was willing to eat crumbs that fell from the children's table. And Jesus responded to her because of this answer, "Go. The demon has gone out of your daughter." Isn't that incredible? Matthew recorded in his gospel account, "O woman, your faith is great. Your faith is great." And when she arrived at her house, she found her daughter lying on the bed and the demon had departed. What a beautiful story. What a beautiful story. And what an incredible faith that this woman had in the face of being challenged with a tag, "You're a dog." Somewhat incredible, I think. Jesus was one who is described in the scriptures as doing all things well. Beginning in verse 31, if you will look with me. "Again, he went out from the region of Tyre and came through Sidon to the Sea of Galilee within the region of Decapolis. They brought to him one who was deaf and spoke with difficulty, and they implored him to lay his hands on him. Jesus took him aside from the crowd by himself and put his fingers into his ears. And after spitting, he touched his tongue with the saliva. And looking up to heaven with a deep sigh, he said to him, 'Ephphatha,'" that is, "be opened. And his ears were opened, and the impediment of his tongue was removed, and he began speaking plainly. And he gave them orders not to tell anyone, but the more he ordered them, the more widely they continued to proclaim it. They were utterly astonished, saying, 'He has done all things well. He makes even the deaf to hear and the mute to speak.'" Mark, moving on from this incident with the Syrophoenician woman, further describes for us that Jesus went into this area of Decapolis that you can see on the map is on the southeastern side of the Sea of Galilee. He's been here before, if you remember. Do you remember something about a man hiding in the tombs? That Jesus cast a demon, a legion of demons, out of him? This is the area where that happened. The area known as 10 cities, a cluster of 10 free cities in this particular area that really preserved high Greek culture, but one where most of the cities in this area were on the eastern side of the Jordan River. Some Jews lived in the territory, but they were a minority presence. Some people heard about Jesus and brought this man to him. His speech was understandably garbled, because when a person can't hear, they can't talk as plainly as a person who can hear. And they implored Jesus to show mercy and heal him, Mark's record says. And verse 36 helps us to understand why. Jesus took him aside from the crowd by himself before acting on the man's behalf. And that makes me think about the celebrity status that Jesus had already attained with the people. and the demands that were created on him in this region where he was to seek out prayer and rest. And he continued to generate this clamor among people where he went. As he did on this occasion, Jesus marked and made emphatic what was happening to the man with physical things, Mark records for us. He did not need to touch someone in order to heal a person, as we saw demonstrated in the event of Mark's report about the Syrophoenician woman's daughter being healed. Jesus didn't touch her, but merely spoke a word, and she was healed. But he not only touched this man, but he put his fingers in his ears, and saliva from his mouth touching his tongue. And maybe Jesus was signifying to the multitude of Gentiles that the healing power came from him as opposed to some other strange and mysterious type of way. The healing power came from him and it was being applied to his hearing and his speech. Maybe that was the case. Jesus uttered a deep sigh. You would think a deep sigh would signify a strong emotion, wouldn't you? And spoke a one-word Aramaic prayer. Ephatha, be open. The man was healed instantly and completely. It wasn't a matter of, now you take these pills and 6 weeks, 8 weeks later, you'll be fine. The healing was instantaneous and complete. And Jesus, as he did on many occasions, ordered them not to tell anyone about it. Why did he do that? The reason for that is not specifically stated here by Mark. And we can think about where he was in his ministry and the purpose that he had. His time was not yet come, and so he had to delay, to some extent, confrontational episodes with the religious leaders of the land. You know, to our knowledge, no one ever tried to knife Jesus in a back alley of Jerusalem or someplace like that. His death would have to be more significant than that because of the meaning behind his death. In what ways would spreading fame begin to interfere with his mission? Would the Jewish leaders be incited to too quickly murder him? Was that God's timetable of events? Maybe. But the word spread and his fame continued to grow. And they saw that he could do things that they described as utterly astonishing. Mark explains to his readers that what those Gentiles saw really fulfilled a Jewish scripture of Isaiah chapter 35, verse 5 and 6. And when it was completed, the people declared, "He has done all things well." That is none other than the verdict of God, if you think about it, on God's own creation at the very beginning of time. When we read about creation and God's hand in that, do we not read something just exactly like this? It's good, it's well, and God is well pleased with it. And it's the same here. These people realized he has done all things well. When Jesus came bringing healing to men's bodies and salvation to their souls, he had begun really a work of recreation in men, don't you think? In the beginning, everything had been good. But man's sin spoiled it all. And so, man needed to be recreated. And I think that's a a worthy thought to think about in a passage like this. And we see further his great compassion that we've talked about before and thought about, shown once again in chapter 8. In those days when there was again a large crowd, and they had nothing to eat, Jesus called his disciples and said to them, "I feel compassion for the people, because they have remained with me now 3 days and have nothing to eat. If I send them away hungry to their homes, they will faint on the way, and some of them have come a great distance." And his disciples answered him, "Where will anyone be able to find enough bread here in this desolate place to satisfy these people?" And he was asking them, "How many loaves do you have?" And they said, 7. And he directed the people to sit down on the ground, and taking the 7 loaves, he gave thanks and broke them and started giving them to the disciples to serve to them. And they served them to the people. And they also had a few small fish. And after he had blessed them, he ordered these to be served as well. And they ate and were satisfied. And they picked up 7 large baskets full of what was left over of the broken pieces. About 4,000 were there, and he sent them away. And immediately he entered his boat with his disciples, came to a different place, a different area. His fame is spreading. People are continually coming to him. People far and wide are hearing reports about him. And soon he found himself among the Gentiles in the same situation, reminiscent of one earlier with the Jewish multitude. In what are clearly 2 distinct episodes, he fed 5,000 plus, 5,000 men plus women and children, earlier you remember, from a snack lunch of 5 small barley loaves and 2 fish. And about 4,000 people in a predominantly pagan territory now from 7 loaves and a few fish. What's the motivation for a miracle like this? Why would Jesus do this? Was he doing this to show that this was a sign from heaven that men ought to pay attention to? Or do you think maybe he was doing this as a compassionate person to feed a hungry multitude? That's really where Mark seems to be taking us in the record of this when he talks about the compassion of Jesus, I think. Not to offer a sign as much as his compassion for people that were hungry, because as Mark records for us, some of them had been trailing Jesus for 3 days without food, for fear that some of them would collapse, faint, become ill on the way back to their homes from lack of nourishment. He began inquiring about their needs. And when he learned that only a handful of barley cakes was available, he did something similar to what he had done before. He had the crowd sit down. And maybe they were expecting another teaching session, another discourse from the Lord. But instead, he took the bread and the few fish, and just like he did earlier, he fed everyone there, and everyone was satisfied. And there was an abundance left over. And Mark wants us to see in this the Lord's compassion. Over and over and over again in the gospel records, we see the Son of God moved with compassion. And I think that's significant. Compassion has this amazing considerateness about it, and I think that's really clear in our text. Considerateness is a virtue that really doesn't forget the details of life. Jesus looked at this crowd that had been with him for 3 days, and he remembered that they hadn't eaten anything. And by now, they must be rather weak, and there's a journey ahead when they're going home. And so his task is, yes, to bring the splendor and the majesty of divine truth before the minds of these people for consideration, to teach them about the love of God. But his thoughts are also, what's going to happen to this congregation on their way home? That's a considerateness. That's a part of compassion, don't you think? Confront Jesus with a lost soul or a tired body, and his first instinct is to help. We could benefit from an example like that, couldn't we? Mark says they ate and were satisfied. He adds the footnote that 7 baskets full of scraps were picked up afterwards, with the needs of the crowd adequately met, so that they could return to their homes. Jesus left with his disciples for an otherwise unknown town. His work among the Gentiles had really helped set the stage for everything that would eventually follow after that. True, the first offer of the gospel was to the Jews, the people of God. They were to be first. But still, there were others to come. We must admire the qualities shown by this Gentile woman. Aren't you impressed with her wit? Aren't you impressed with her persistence? Aren't you impressed with the fact that she knew what she wanted and she wasn't going to take no for an answer? Aren't you impressed with the fact that she went to the right source for the answer? What an incredible faith. And I think Mark's readers would really get the point of that, don't you? Jesus is praised for doing God's work in healing even among pagan, sick people, needy folks, folks that would be unclean in a Jewish environment. And that clean and unclean are really not permanent conditions, as we see later in the good book. God can take the unclean man and make him clean, whether he's a Jew or a Gentile. God can do it. And nobody who is unclean has to stay that way. He can be made clean. You don't have to label him and write him off because he's unclean. Unclean is just really a label which really means needing to be made clean, I think. I know why the Pharisees hated Jesus. Because why? When the Pharisees had everything worked down to this fine point, when Jesus got there, religion was just a matter of going to the right place, the synagogue, on the right day, the Sabbath day, listening to the right person, the rabbi, feeling reverent and going on to do whatever you did the rest of the week, which may involve something like devouring widows' houses. And then you dress up and you come back the next Sabbath day for the same thing. And it was all just so neat, so neatly packaged and wrapped with a ribbon on it that no one really got upset about it. And it didn't bother you. But when Jesus came, he made that troublesome. And it should have been. He made it personal. Not one place, not one day, not one person, but 24 hours a day. And with your whole heart. That's the way Jesus made it when he came. And he showed forth a God, not a God that is merely satisfied by a checklist of things that we do, even though we must do what God commands us to do. but a God who becomes so real and so personal to you that your thoughts are, how does God feel about this? How does God feel about that? How does God feel about the way I'm thinking now? How does God feel about what I'm doing today? And that makes it real. And that's what Jesus came to tell us. The challenge of Christianity is beautiful, above every other challenge that men are faced with. And that's worth sacrificing everything you have to attain it. And every day becomes a transformation into His image. That's real Christianity. And that's what Jesus came to give. Yes, the Pharisees hated Jesus for showing them that very thing about religion. And there are people that are still like that today. But what about you? If you're in our assembly tonight and you've come to believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and the religion of God from your whole heart, totally, is set before you in a way that you want it, and you'll give everything for it. You can become a Christian even this very night. There would be rejoicing in heaven. There would be rejoicing in this multitude to see someone obey the gospel of Jesus Christ today and put Him on and have sins washed away. Can we help you with that tonight? If we can, please come. And let us help you while we stand together and encourage you by the singing of this song.